There are some who can live without wild things and some who cannot. For us of the minority, the opportunity to see geese is more important than television, and the chance to find a pasque flower is a right as inalienable as free speech. So said Aldo Leopold, noted 20th century conservationist. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Aldo Leopold is best known for his 1949 book, A Sand County Almanac, written when he was a professor at the UW-Madison. What is less known, even to many Leopold followers, is that in the 1930s he did a series of radio talks that were broadcast right here over Wisconsin Public Radio. Today we'll explore Aldo Leopold, including the context and content of those radio talks, with UW Professor Emeritus Stanley Temple, who for 32 years held the faculty position that Aldo Leopold once occupied, and who is now a senior fellow with the Aldo Leopold Foundation. Welcome back to University of the Air.
It's good to be here, Emily.
Well, let's start with, before we get to these intriguing radio shows that Leopold did in the 1930s that really have not been sampled by most people or even known about, let's just do a quick overview of Leopold himself. If you are talking to someone on an airplane trip and they say, you know, what do you do when you're trying to talk about Leopold and they say, I've never heard of him, how would you respond?
Well, Aldo Leopold is generally regarded as one of the most influential conservation thinkers that the United States has produced. And his career is a remarkable one, that it spans several eras in the development of conservation in the United States, and that he contributed in so many different ways to the conservation movement. He started his career as a forester in the U.S. Forest Service, the brand new U.S. Forest Service, had just been created under Teddy Roosevelt. And he spent the first 15 years of his career working in the Forest Service in the Southwest, in the Arizona and New Mexico territories. They weren't even states back then. But this young guy, just fresh out of Yale School of Forestry, ended up being responsible for literally millions of acres of publicly owned wildland in the Southwest. And although he did some remarkable things there, he helped create one of the first designated wilderness areas on public land in the U.S., you could tell that his heart really wasn't in forestry. It was in wildlife. And throughout his career in the Forest Service, he dabbled in wildlife conservation. And then in 1924, he gets promoted and transferred to Madison, Wisconsin, to the Forest Products Laboratory, which still exists here on campus up on a hill on Walnut Street, to be the associate director. And things kind of went downhill for Leopold with regard to the Forest Service during the subsequent 4 years. He was very unhappy with his position and became increasingly engaged in wildlife conservation.
Why was he unhappy with his position?
Well, as an associate director who was cursed with a director who was, I think we could say, threatened by this bright guy, Aldo Leopold, and gave Leopold essentially nothing to do. At the same time, Leopold was frustrated that his ideas about managing national forests using what we might today call ecosystem management rather than managing just as a source of forest products, it wasn't getting much of an ear in the administration of the Forest Service. So he did something quite remarkable in 1928. Remarkable, maybe even foolhardy. He quit cold turkey.
And that's with a family, I think, too.
He has a wife, five kids. Mm-hmm. He's got a high-paying, very secure government job that really isn't asking him to do much except pursue his own interests in wildlife conservation. But he quits without any clue what he's going to do next, really. And he spends the next 3 years on a project, a contract job, essentially, traveling around the eight north-central states, essentially the Great Lakes states, and the state of Mississippi, doing unprecedented on-the-ground surveys of the status of wildlife populations and wildlife conservation. In fact, this is a little side project that I've been doing, is retracing his journey. And I just returned yesterday from Mississippi. But this 3 years of looking at conditions on the ground were very insightful for Aldo Leopold and gave him enough material to really start to forge his own identity in the field of wildlife conservation.
And someone was paying for him to do this field?
Yes, he was actually, it's kind of interesting that the contract was with a trade group called the Sporting Arms and Ammunition Manufacturers Institute, and they were worried about their bottom line.
So this would be for hunting?
For hunting, yeah. Exactly. And they were worried about their bottom line because wildlife populations then were really in a terrible state. It's hard to believe today how depleted many species that are common today, things like white-tailed deer, were scarce in mm-hmm. Wisconsin. But they were interested in their bottom line. Simply with fewer game species to hunt, they weren't selling as many hunting equipment items. So Leopold does this survey, and it was an interesting, when I said earlier that he sort of spanned eras in wildlife conservation, and this tour around the Great Lakes states allowed him to actually be the person who largely shifted the paradigm. When he took this job with the Sporting Arms Group, there, I think, was a pretty clear expectation that he was going to find that the depletion of game species, of wildlife species, was due to a failure of protection, a failure of regulations. This was pretty sharp on the heels of the passenger pigeon going extinct and the bison just about going mm-hmm. extinct. So the mindset was, if something's wrong with wildlife, it must be because we're killing them. And as a result, the first sort of paradigm of wildlife conservation in the U.S. was very much focused on protection. And Leopold came in after these 3 years looking at conditions on the ground with a completely new paradigm. He said the status of wildlife had little to do with the failure of protection. It had everything to do with the habitat. And that was actually a rather revolutionary idea in 1931 when he issued his final report. But it gave him the insight to essentially shift the paradigm away from wildlife protection to wildlife management. The idea that you could actually manipulate the environment, manipulate the habitat of wildlife to achieve conservation goals. And he used that insight to write a book called Game Management. It was published in 1933, and it was the first textbook, if you will, the first reference book in this new field of wildlife management, a field that Aldo Leopold largely invented and gave identity to. 1933 was obviously a very good year for Aldo Leopold. He publishes this blockbuster book, and he gets a position at the University of Wisconsin. A rather unlikely occurrence, actually, when you think about it. It's still the Depression years. The university's budget probably was in worse shape than it is now. Here's this guy, Aldo Leopold, who has no graduate degree, has never taught a course in his life, and who is representing a field that had never before been represented in academia. And yet the UW College of Agriculture took a big gamble and hired him and gave him an unprecedented position, a chair in game management. And I think he got the position with a little help from his friends. Harry Russell, who had been the dean of the College of Agriculture, was a good friend of Aldo Leopold's. They were hunting buddies. Several other influential individuals in Madison were Aldo Leopold's hunting and birdwatching buddies, and they put some pressure on the university to give him a position. It took several years for it to finally happen, but in 1933, Aldo Leopold is given this position. And he spends the next 15 years of his life until he dies in 1948 as a professor at the university. First, as a chair in game management, after he had proven his worth, he was given a name change and given his own department, so a department of wildlife management, and he became a professor of wildlife management.
I said in my introduction that you actually have the position that he had in some way. Now, is that in more, these days we would say, wildlife ecology, or kind of what did it morph into?
That's right. The department that Leopold created was called the Department of Wildlife Management. That name did change to the Department of Wildlife Ecology, in no small part because Leopold himself had changed the names of the courses that he was teaching from Principles of Wildlife Management to Principles of Wildlife Ecology. And now, actually after my retirement, the department is now merged with forestry. So it is now the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology.
Well, obviously you have a very close connection to Aldo Leopold in terms of how you your work and your passion for this subject area. Tell me about this search for the radio programs that he did.
Well, the radio programs were a little-known aspect of Leopold's time as a professor. Because he was a professor in the College of Agriculture, a land-grant school with the Wisconsin idea and an expectation that professors would engage in outreach and extension activities, Aldo Leopold was apparently asked within 2 weeks of taking on his faculty position to start doing a series of radio talks on WHA radio on a program, I assume a predecessor of this program, called College of the Air. And he did them at irregular intervals, and the topics were essentially related to what was on Aldo's mind and his position. So they had to do with game management. They were very much focused on how wildlife management, game management could be practiced on the farm, given that his appointment was in the College of Agriculture. And they went on for several years as irregular programs. His last program was done in 1936.
And we're still talking about a decade before he would write the Sand County Almanac, the work that would really make him famous. Is not these radio shows are long before that.
Absolutely. Leopold, as I hinted, you know, touched on so many aspects of conservation. And part of that was that he was almost constantly evolving. And even at the time that he took this unprecedented new position as a professor of game management, when the dean of the College of Agriculture asked him to describe what he was going to do with this new position, Leopold had already shifted his focus away from purely thinking about how you manage game species, species that are hunted, to thinking more broadly about wildlife and the land, as he called it. And more than that, in his description of his new position, he introduced a concept that would become a sort of a dominant challenge to him through the 15 years of his career at the University of Wisconsin. And that was the much broader issue of how do you protect the public's interest on private land. A big challenge. If you're dealing with wildlife here in the Midwest, where almost all the land is private, it's clear if you're going to do wildlife management, it's going to have to happen on private land. When you look at water, when you look at erosion problems, when you look at virtually all of our conservation issues throughout much of the U.S. where so much land is privately owned, Leopold realized that the solution to conservation problems ultimately would have to come through working with private landowners. And this conundrum, if you will, of how do you get the private landowner to do things that are in the public interest inevitably led him to the concept for which he is perhaps most famous and the one that he introduced in his book, A Sand County Almanac, was his land ethic. The idea that we have a moral responsibility toward nature. And he looked at it this way. He recognized that human beings live in a human community. and that there are certain ethical guidelines that are necessary for that community to function properly. And similarly, using an ecological analog, he said that human beings also live in an ecological community. We live with all of the other creatures that inhabit the earth. And just as there should be some moral guidelines for living in a human community, there should be some moral guidelines for living in this ecological community. And that is what he posed as the land ethic. Leopold used the word land not for soil. He used it as a word for, we might say, the ecosystem.
Yeah.
So we've come full circle now. Leopold died of a heart attack at age 61. Just 2 weeks after he learned that his book, A Sand County Almanac, was going to be published. So he never actually saw it in print and couldn't have imagined the impact that it was going to have for generations.
Now, I know you have transcripts of some of the radio shows, but we have no recordings of Leopold's own voice at this point. So tell me, how did you get the transcripts then?
Well, in the Wildlife Department, we do have quite a few Leopold artifacts, if you will. And, of course, in the UW library system, in the UW archives, is an extensive holding of Leopold's archival material. In fact, it's the largest individual archival holding that the university possesses.
No, I didn't know that.
And it's one that has been digitized so that it's accessible online. But in his papers that are left in the department and the copies of that material that are in the archives, I discovered early in my career were his scripts that he read from when he did these radio talks. And I always thought, well, that was really kind of neat that we know what he said on these programs, even though, as you indicated, we don't have actual recordings of the show, something we can return to later. But I read them and thought, wow, these are really a nice little peek into Leopold's head in the early 1930s when he was producing these radio shows. And indeed, you know, when most people, as you said in the introduction, are not aware that he did these radio shows, and on the 100th anniversary of Wisconsin Public Radio, it seemed appropriate to sort of bring them back into the public's view.
And definitely to have them back on University of the Air, if he had read them on College of the Air with the idea that everyone can share in learning all across the state, that seems very fitting. Can you start with an early example of what he would have said on the air? And well, this is, you said, from 1933?
1933. And as I said, his first radio show is on September 8th, 1933. So literally, it's in his first 2 weeks in his chair of game management. And he has sort of given the series of talks a general title, which was Building a Wisconsin Game Crop. And this was a concept that he was pushing with mostly rural private landowners, mostly farmers, that just as they could raise a crop of plants or animals on their land, they could raise a crop of wildlife. So his first talk, he talks about leaving food and cover, the two essential elements of the habitat that would be necessary to support wildlife populations on the farm. And although he is a professor. Throughout these talks, he does not identify himself as Professor Aldo Leopold. He identifies himself as Aldo Leopold, game manager.
He must have been thinking about his audience.
I think he was.
And not wanting to be pegged as an elitist Madison professor, but rather somebody who was in the field, someone who would be on the ground.
I think you're absolutely right, Emily, and I think that was an insight that came from those 3 years traveling around the Midwest talking to private landowners and farmers and knowing how to approach them.
So now we'll pretend it's September 8th, 1933,
And
we'll pretend your voice is that of Aldo Leopold.
Yeah, I wish. So a little excerpt from this, and it's a nice little historical piece because he talks about some of the things that he has been doing in Wisconsin. So he said the city dweller interested in game can do little about it except to make speeches about conservation. The farmer, however, can actually raise a game crop on his farm, which is a much more useful service to conservation than making speeches. Anybody can deplore the passing of the good old days, but to help bring them back is the special privilege of farmers. Most people refuse to believe that this can be done. Just the same, it is being done, and right here in Wisconsin. For example, I know of one group of seven farmers near Riley in Dane County who had one covey of quail between them in 1931. Today, they have 25 coveys. They have not planted a single quail. The increase came automatically when they began leaving food and cover for the birds. It does not matter whether your object is better hunting or just the pleasure of having wild birds around. The method of cropping is the same. Leave food and cover, and the crop will raise itself. Now, the reference there to Riley. Riley is a tiny little community in western Dane County where Alto Leopold did some of his first experiments on engaging private landowners, these seven farmers, and convincing them to join him and his hunting buddies from Madison in trying to improve the habitat on their farms. It was a pioneering effort. No one had ever tried this type of, as he called it, a cooperative before. And as he said, the results were pretty impressive on these 1,700 acres that they managed.
Well, and he seems quite strategic in making it clear that he's not speaking as a city dweller giving speeches, but really I'm talking directly to farmers who actually can do something. So that's interesting. We're going to sample more of the early radio talks of Aldo Leopold when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
One of the pleasures which is denied the landless multitude of the cities, but which is accessible to every farmer, is the opportunity to see and live with wild birds. Winter is the time to see birds at close range. The whole bird world, if you want it, will perform for you daily under your very windowsill. The price of the show is a little forethought and a few handfuls of feed.
That's from part of a radio talk by Aldo Leopold called Feeding Winter Birds on the Farm from December of 1933, read by my guest, Stanley Temple. We're talking about Aldo Leopold's long-lost WHA radio talks, among other things. You know, you can hear a little bit of the sort of use of metaphor and analogy and so on that made him famous for writing Sand County Almanac in the next decade. Because all aside from being this pioneer of conservation and someone who really championed the idea of a land ethic, Aldo Leopold was a brilliant use of a wordsmith. You know, he used words like a poet sometimes.
He was a storyteller par excellence, and a lot of scientists could learn from Leopold's style of communication because it was so very effective. And he loves to tell stories. I can read another one here about the farm woodlot. Obviously, one of the few pieces of habitat that many farms still have.
And this is also from December 1933?
This is from December of 1933, again, during his first semester as a professor. So he says, the era of the Wisconsin lumberjack ended in the gay 90s. In those days, Paul Bunyan was our most powerful citizen. But when the pineries gave out, he harnessed up Babe, his blue ox, and moved west. Wisconsin has not seen him since. Except for the forest fires, which still run on his old slashings, there may seem to be nobody left to compare with Paul as a destroyer of Wisconsin timber. Any such notion, however, is mistaken. Paul has a successor at large in the woods who works with less noise and bluster, but no whit less effectiveness than he. I say he, but this is really misleading. The modern Paul, strange as it may seem, is a lady lumberjack. Who is she? She is the dairy cow. And he goes on to say, "Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not defaming the Wisconsin cow, nor do I begrudge her the privilege of grazing in woodlots. I'm pointing out that if we want any woods on the Wisconsin dairy farm of 1950, particularly woods with enough undergrowth to harbor birds, then the cow must not be allowed access to all of the woodlots all of the time. Your woodlot is, in fact, a historical document which faithfully records your personal philosophy. Let it tell a story of tolerance toward living things and of skill in the greatest of all arts, how to use the earth without making it ugly." Leopold would later, in an essay that is often quoted called "The Farmer as a Conservationist," and the quote is that the landscape of any farm is the owner's portrait of himself. Mm-hmm. You can see the clear link between the 1933 radio mm-hmm. talk and this famous quote about farmers painting a portrait on their land.
Well, that's a clever link that he uses at the beginning between Paul Bunyan and a dairy cow, because it seems so incongruous, but then it kind of makes sense when you start to think about it. So he kind of draws people in with the narrative.
And I think it's perhaps important to note that cows in the woodlot are pretty much a thing of the past. And today, we recognize that there is another animal in the woodlots that's doing the same type of damage to the vegetation that the grazing cows did back in Leopold's time, and that's our burgeoning population of white-tailed deer.
Did Leopold have to think about deer as part of what he was doing with game management?
He absolutely did, and Leopold became a central figure in debates about deer in the state of Wisconsin. He recognized fairly early on that as the white-tailed deer population started to recover, as a wildlife biologist, he could see what was coming, and that was an explosive growth in the deer population. And he eventually, in the early 1940s, when he was a conservation commissioner, argued very strenuously that now, in the early 1940s, was the time to start using hunting as a way to control the deer population. And he warned that if we didn't, the deer population would get out of control and we would no longer really be able to use hunting as an effective tool. So even as early as his radio shows in the 1930s, he talks about deer. And in the same context, really, as the cow destroying the understory and plants in the woods. So let me end up with a plan for a scientific study of the deer problem. We are all guessing on deer questions. No analysis of the situation has ever been made. In the sense of wildlife management, no one knows anything about deer in this state. History is full of instances of states which paid no attention to deer problems until they were in trouble, and then it was too late to avoid calamity. Well, here we are. Almost 80 years later, and we're seeing the ecological calamity, if you will, of having an overabundant deer population that Leopold was clearly giving warnings about so long ago.
At the time that Leopold was doing his work, we're in the 1930s now with these radio talks, was there a suspicion about conservationists, you know, those who were trying to preserve land, the way these days you can sometimes find a division where environmentalists are pegged as tree huggers, and there is a sort of a dichotomy sometimes between those who are working the land, hunting the land, versus those who are in environmental groups?
No, it was a problem in Leopold's time, just as it often is portrayed as a dichotomy today. In Leopold's time, the divide was between, as they described themselves, protectionists, who were sort of wedded to that sort of pre-Leopold paradigm, mm-hmm. and conservationists, who were more in tune with Leopold's ideas about management. And Leopold easily moved between these two groups. He was a bird watcher. Mm-hmm. Most people, if you look at the photographs of Aldo Leopold, most of them when he's in the field, he either has a pair of birding binoculars around his neck or a gun in his hand. Mm-hmm. And those were two activities that that he enjoyed. And as a result, he felt quite comfortable speaking to bird groups and to hunting groups.
And who do you think the audience was for these radio talks? You know, who heard him?
Well, that's a good question, Emily, and I'm not sure. There's mm-hmm. nothing in the scripts that I have that indicate the time.
And no mail to him. You know, I heard you on the radio. What do you mean saying
well,
such and such?
Well, there actually were quite a few letters to him. And he, in one of his talks in January of 1934, he ends his talk, says, if anyone wants a summary of the methods that he had just been talking about, write for it, addressing your letter to the game manager, College of Agriculture, Madison. Still talking mm-hmm. about himself as the game mm-hmm. manager, not as the professor. And there were letters that he answered with questions. You would guess if his main target audience was on the farm, that his shows might have been early in the morning when the farmers mm-hmm. would have been in the barn. But on the other hand, a lot of his topics, he's clearly making the primary focus on the rural landowners, but he brings the urbanite in as well. So, for example, in several of his talks, he clearly sort of hints at the sort of urban-rural divide. So in this talk from February 17th, 1936, we constantly hear speeches and read articles by public officials, legislators, and officers of conservation organizations expressing their enthusiasm for conservation and their determination to make it a success. These expressions of good intent are fine, but certainly conservation needs their help. But I often wonder whether these gentlemen realize that they are talking about a contest in which they are onlookers, not the players. Enthusiasm in the bleachers is a great asset, but it's hardly a substitute for a team to do the work. The farmers are the team in the wildlife conservation. Unless the farmer and other private landowners of America take an interest in practicing conservation on their holdings, the whole public movement must eventually collapse. So there he is, mm-hmm. bringing pretty inclusive everyone mm-hmm. who's involved in conservation together and focusing the attention where he thinks it should be, which is on private landowners, whether those are farmers or other type of landholders.
And he almost seems, as he has in the earlier things that you read, he seems to be flattering in many ways, probably strategically, the farmers, the people who are doing the work compared to those sitting in the bleachers doing the speeches.
I think that's true. I mean, I think he realizes that, if he can reach the landowners, he'll get a lot more accomplished than he will talking to legislators at the state capitol.
But there's
capital.
An irony, too, if you have a professor giving a radio address. He is, in fact, doing some speech making.
Yes. Absolutely.
But he's presenting himself as sort of more of a common man then. I noticed, too, that the diction he's choosing, it would be readily accessible to anyone. He's avoiding jargon and keeping the sort of politics out.
It is amazing that there are very, very few highfalutin ecological mm-hmm. terms in here. He does put it in common language, and he has almost a conversational character to it. Let me read another one from 1934. I wish I had a dollar for every farmer I've heard lamenting the good old days of abundant wildlife. I wish even more that I had some way to make the bird lovers of Wisconsin realize that this lament is only half true. Well, you may ask, what shall we do about it? Before trying to answer, let me nail down just who are we. I want to make it clear that no one can possibly do anything about it except the man who owns the land on which the food and cover grows. The rest of us can do nothing but aid and abet his efforts. In this sense, the young farmer of today is the nation's foremost conservationist. He actually holds the reins of power. Neither the governor, nor the legislature, nor Congress, nor the president can do anything substantial to conserve farm game without his active participation. My message to the College of the Air is simply this. The young man on the farm today may not have a chance to build himself a fortune, but he has a chance to build himself the kind of enjoyment which kings try to buy and don't always get. One of these is abundant wildlife, to be hunted or just looked at as you please. The method is the same in either event. So once again, he's clearly trying to bridge that urban-rural divide, if you will, that we speak about so much today. And he does it in a very simple language. He doesn't blame anyone. He's cajoling, if you will, landowners to join him in this experiment to see whether he can bring back wildlife on private land through the management approaches that he is developing and championing here at the University of Wisconsin.
And at the time that he gave that speech, besides the idea of dairy cows that are grazing and, you know, kind of depleting resources, what is in his head as the sort of chief abuses that the farmers and landowners that he's speaking to, you know, what is it that's bothering him? He's being strategic. He's being, you know, tactful and so on. But I'm guessing that there are some things that he's hoping will stop.
Well, you have to put this into the historical context. Mm-hmm. He's writing this just on the heels when there was a major shift in agriculture in the U.S. It was the period when farmers shifted from horse power to horsepower. It's when farming became mechanized, when it was possible for the farmer to clear much more land, to farm much more land, when, as Leopold called it, clean farming, where essentially cultivated land often covered most of a farmer's property and little in the way of natural habitat was left. So he was very concerned that the direction that the agricultural landscape was going was, to his way of thinking, a direction that was going to lead to a real devastating absence of wildlife habitat on much of America's farmland. So when he was well aware that the private landowner, the farmer, really was where it was at, he identified a number of problems. Certainly, foremost in his mind was wildlife. But he also wrote extensively about soil and water conservation.
And when you say wildlife, you mean leaving enough habitat that is undeveloped, uncultivated, so that the whole ecosystem stays intact, like just leaving more acres that are left alone in their wild state?
That's exactly right. Leaving things as simple as hedgerows between your fields, managing your back 40 woodlot in a way that continued to provide habitat for wildlife.
And are there particular species? I know you said he was shifting the paradigm so that it's less focused on the extinction of one particular animal like the passenger pigeon. But are there some sort of threatened species at this point, either of plants or animals, that he really is worried about?
Well, as a professor of game management, you know, his first focus, especially in these early talks, was on game species. And the popular game species in Wisconsin were terribly depleted or in some cases just plain gone. It's hard to believe today that white-tailed deer were incredibly scarce, so much so that there was closed seasons in many years for them, that the state of Wisconsin had a captive breeding program for raccoons so that they could be restocked. The things that were such a common part of the rural landscape, like bobwhite quail, were disappearing, as were prairie chickens, as grasslands were being converted to row crops. So it was a period of time in which there was great concern about many wildlife species that have today, for the most part, often come back. So that white-tailed deer, of course, are now so abundant that we consider them to be something of a nuisance. Wild turkey were gone from Wisconsin in Leopold's time. And now, of course, we have them roaming around on the UW campus and on the Capitol Square. Yes.
Yes.
So there have been some remarkable success stories that can be traced back to Leopold's identification of, as he often called it, the crux of the problem.
We're going to look more at some early radio programs by Aldo Leopold when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Stanley Temple. We are talking about Aldo Leopold, the great Wisconsin conservationist. We've been sampling some of his long-lost WHA radio talks. There's some transcripts showing what he actually said on the air back in the 1930s. Is anything that Leopold said back then in the nature of being controversial or might have gotten him some critics?
Well, I can speak to one thing that has a very personal connection. Many decades after Leopold's time, I did some pioneering work on the impact that free-ranging cats have on wildlife. And, of course, I wasn't the first wildlife biologist to note that free-ranging cats do a lot of damage to wildlife. And Aldo Leopold was certainly aware, even in his day, that cats were a threat to many species. So this is one of his early talks again, when he talks about winter bird feeding, and he makes the comment that it is necessary, of course, to keep the yard free of cats. Too many dogs or squirrels are likewise undesirable. On moonlit nights, rabbits will give you an evening performance after the bird matinee is over. So he did have a lot of warnings about some of the threats to wildlife, and certainly cats were one of them. Leopold was, as I was saying, of course, interested in far more than just wildlife. And his interests in soil and water conservation were strong. And yet, surprisingly, he doesn't talk much about that on his radio shows. He sticks pretty closely to the game wildlife topic, which was, of course, what I guess was expected of him as a professor of game management rather than someone who was an expert on soil and water conservation, although he was. In 1933, when he was a brand new professor, he was an important part of the nation's first watershed management project over in Coon Valley, Wisconsin. And it was in no small part due to Leopold's encouragement that that project shifted. Dealing with farmers who in that highly erodible landscape were causing some horrible erosion problems, Leopold convinced his colleagues in the college and in the federal government to look at the problem more holistically, not just try to fix the erosion problem, but to look at the farm as an ecosystem, to consider the soil, the plants, the water, the entire system that they were trying to manage.
Did he ever go after the timber industry or anything that would be sort of targeting those who are depleting the forests?
Well, you have to put yourself back in the 1930s. Wisconsin, at least the commercially valuable timber, had mostly been clear-cut by the late 1800s and the early 1900s. So the forest of Wisconsin, especially northern mm-hmm. Wisconsin, was just in early stages of growth. Today, we're looking at it, you know, a century later, and we see a forested landscape. That wasn't what it looked like over 100 years ago when it was pretty much clear-cut.
And what else in his radio shows kind of jumps out to you as something that's a treasure to find?
Well, one of the things that he touches on, and it may be one of the most controversial topics that he touched on, was the issue of human populations. And in one of his shows, he talks about an analogy, if you will, between what's happening, what he observes happening in wildlife populations and what's happening in the human population. So he says the population level of any species, including ourselves, may go into violent vibration at any time. Again, avoiding jargon. It's not unthinkable that the present worldwide disturbances, which we call revolution, depression, and realpolitik, are the preliminary rumblings of nature over an unhealthy population density.
He's talking about overpopulation of
humans. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Which at the time would have probably been a relatively controversial issue to bring up. But he does it, of course, in the context of the rest of his talk, which is basically describing the fluctuations in wildlife populations and how an increase above a certain level leads to ecological problems and often a collapse of the population. In that same talk where he makes the parallel between wildlife populations and human populations, he ends up with this quote, "What I'm trying to say is that the study of wildlife cycles may ultimately throw light on sociology as well as conservation." Now, you have to flip forward almost 50 years when E.O. Wilson wrote his very controversial book on sociobiology, which basically was an expansion of Leopold's ideas that we can learn a lot about humans from studying nature.
Do you think he brought that up because he's trying to, in a sense, sell his own profession or the importance of it, or, you know, what? In presenting a talk where he's talking about human overpopulation and suggesting that also looking at wildlife populations might tell us something about ourselves, what do you think his motive might have been?
Well, I think although he did not write about this extensively, it must have been perfectly clear to him that the population growth was eventually going to put great stress on the natural resources that were his focus. And I think that was just Aldo Leopold once again being perhaps, as he often was, way ahead of his time in pointing out some of the issues that perhaps no one paid much attention to in his time, but that would become very important in the future. And indeed, a good analogy is just his book, A Sand County Almanac. Mm-hmm. It was pretty much, most people don't realize, it was rejected by multiple publishers who basically all said pretty much the same thing. We don't think there's a readership for this type of book. And when Oxford University published A Sand County Almanac, basically the other publishers were right. Sand County Almanac was pretty much a bust. It wasn't until really the 1970s, late 1960s and early 1970s, that the sales of A Sand County Almanac took off. After the modern environmental movement kicked off, and suddenly, 20-odd years after Leopold had written this book, suddenly now there was an audience ready to read his ideas and understand the points that he was trying to make in the book.
I know this is hypothetical, but what do you think if Aldo Leopold were alive now and looked around the state of the country, state of Wisconsin, and he had a chance to come on University of the Air, what would be his biggest issue, do you think?
Well, those of us who have thought a lot about Aldo Leopold realize there's a danger in trying to put words in Aldo Leopold's mouth. But I think we probably could guess how he would have thought about many of the issues of today. And I think he gave us a pretty good clue in A Sand County Almanac that he would look at many of our environmental problems today through an ethical lens. And, of course, his famous golden rule, if you will, that a thing is right when it tends to preserve the integrity, stability, and beauty of the natural community. It is wrong when it tends otherwise, would give us a clue of his prescription, really, for how to address many of the problems today.
I saw on the website for the Aldo Leopold Foundation that you're a senior fellow with that there is this sort of, I guess, search going on your part, hoping that someone somewhere, just the way you read about someone discovering a first edition of a valuable manuscript or a, you know, unknown Picasso sketch or something, that somebody is going to find the actual radio recording somewhere. Tell us about that.
Well, this did become a personal quest of mine when we were producing the Emmy Award-winning film Green Fire about Aldo Leopold's life. And we thought it would be really a nice touch to have Aldo Leopold's voice. And knowing that his radio talks on WHA had been recorded, I thought this was going to be easy. We'll just go to the archives and either the station or the university will have preserved the recordings. Not so. Proved to be much more difficult. His shows, his talks were recorded, but the technology in the 1930s was not tape recording. It was what are known as transcription discs. For those of you who are old enough to remember 78 RPM records, these were big discs. They were of two types. There were either vinyl-coated glass discs or vinyl-coated aluminum discs. And the recording, of course, was made on the vinyl. So as I have searched in vain through many a wild goose chase, it appears that WHA recorded Aldo Leopold's show and other shows of that era on vinyl-coated aluminum discs. And in World War II, virtually everything in the country made out of aluminum that wasn't precious was recycled for the war effort. And we have virtually none of the aluminum discs in the university archives or here at the station. Over the years, there have been tantalizing hints that they may have been squirreled away somewhere. I was told long before I was searching for them that a fairly famous conservation historian in the state named Walter Scott had taken possession of these. He had a vast collection of Wisconsin conservation historical documents. When he died, however, his collection was broken up, and no one could verify whether there might have been any transcription disc. So for the time being, who knows? They may be in somebody's attic or basement somewhere. But as far as we know, there are no recordings of Aldo Leopold's voice.
If they were in somebody's basement, would they still play? I mean, do you think they'd last?
Well, there were a couple of discs in the UW archives. They were glass. And the archivist was very reluctant to allow them to be played. These were discs that had lost their label, so he didn't know what was on them. So, of course, my wish was that, oh my gosh, maybe one of these unlabeled discs would have Aldo Leopold on it.
But it's great that you've got these transcripts and that they're part of a really large digital archive that exists.
Absolutely. If people can go to the Leopold Archive, if you just search on the Leopold Archive, you can go to the archives. You can actually read all of his scripts. I've only given you just very short excerpts from them. But you can actually read his radio talks as well as just about everything that Aldo Leopold ever wrote. What you won't find, though, is a recording of his voice.
If there had been no Aldo Leopold, if it just had not been an Aldo Leopold, what do you think we would have missed out on?
Well, when you go back and you look at Aldo Leopold's time, he was not the only person who was thinking along perhaps the same lines. What made him really stand out, and what is perfectly clear in these radio transcripts, is that he was the most effective communicator of the bunch. He was the one who could present complicated ideas. He was the one who could put ideas into language that people understood. He was skillful with his use of language. He was obviously a very skillful writer, as anyone who's read a Sand County Almanac will acknowledge. And I think that probably as much as anything is what made Aldo Leopold clearly stand out from the pack. Most scientists don't possess. We're pretty good at speaking to each other, but often are pretty miserable in our ability to communicate with the general public or with politicians.
Well, I have to say you've done a great job yourself. My guest has been Stanley Temple. Thank you for bringing Aldo Leopold's words to life in this exploration of his long-lost WHA radio talks.
You're very welcome.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.